Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the good news from the recent elections, in as much as the Democratic Party's gains at the state level are beginning to blunt the Koch brothers' finance Republican strategy that succeeded in 2010 to change our politics at the state level so that the minority party, fueled by its largest donors, could hold on to power through gerrymandering and the Electoral College. Nancy McLean, Professor of History and Public Policy at Duke University, whose latest book is Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America, joins us to discuss her article at The Guardian, Democrats Were Once Invisible in State Politics, Those Days Are Over. We'll explore successful ballot initiatives indicating a hunger for progressive policies in what seemed like terminally red states, such as Arkansas, Missouri, Utah, Nebraska, Idaho, and Arizona, where six mothers organized a massive grassroots fight against a Koch-backed ballot measure to privatize public education, which won by a 2-1 victory. However, the Kochs are forging ahead with their biggest and most radical project yet, which is close to getting enough states to ratify its convening under Article 5 of the Constitution, a convention of the states, which once convened would enable a few billionaires to rewrite the American Constitution to their liking and according to their wishes. Then we will speak with Matt Karp, a professor of history at Princeton University and author of This Vast Southern Empire, Slaveholders at the Helm of American Foreign Policy, about his article at Jacobin Magazine, 51% Losers. He joins us to discuss how, while the Republican Party is the party of the billionaires, the Democratic Party is the party of the millionaires, with the Democrats winning 42 of the 50 wealthiest districts in the country. He argues that professional class politics are a cul-de-sac for the Democrats and that they need a political revolution driven by the needs and aspirations of the multiracial working class. Then finally, with President Trump lashing out like a trapped animal at the Mueller investigation while offering insane voter fraud conspiracy theories that people put on hats and walk around the blocks to vote again, in a White House where the First Lady gets to decide who serves on the National Security Council, we will assess whether dysfunction has devolved into dementia. A 28-year veteran senior congressional staffer, Mike Lofgren, the author of The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of the Shadow Government, joins us to discuss the sacking of the mini-me of National Security Advisor John Bolton, who Lofgren refers to as the walrus from hell. And joining us now is Nancy McLean, the award-winning author of Behind the Mask of Chivalry and Freedom is Not Enough. She is the William H. Chafe Professor of History and Public Policy at Duke University, and her latest book is Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. And she has an article at The Guardian, Democrats Were Once Invisible in State Politics, Those Days Are Over. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nancy McLean.
It's great to be with you again, Ian.
Well, thank you, Nancy. And we've spoken before about the Koch brothers and their extraordinary influence over American politics. And I think their greatest success is how much they've managed to distract Americans from the issue of inequality for which they are the sort of poster boys. And I had a conversation the other day with Lawrence Lessig at Harvard, who ran for president, and he's been a real champion trying to get money out of politics. And he made a very succinct case, which I just wanted to run by you, which is that in America today, a few people earning $10,000 an hour have managed to convince a lot of people earning $40 an hour that people earning $8 an hour are America's biggest problem.
Wow, that's very powerfully said. Yeah.
Isn't that? And
that
really
that puts it right in perspective. And that's absolutely what I saw, you know, in my research is the origins of this story of makers and takers that has now become the dominant Republican narrative and the narrative on the right, this notion that somehow, you know, people who are struggling to get by, who need help to get health care and so forth and so on, that they are somehow the parasites, and these people who are making $10,000 an hour are the good, you know, productive contributors. And it's just, it's breathtaking in its capacity to kind of bamboozle the public. It doesn't stand up to empirical analysis at all, and it really leads us to miss the way that these people who are riding on top of all of us have rigged the rules so that the process pretty much at this point only benefits them, not those people who are making $40,000, I mean $40 an hour or $8 an hour or any place else on the spectrum, even up through the, you know, 95%, I think.
Well, to some extent, the Koch brothers have replaced the Republican Party in terms
yes.
of their machinery of polling and getting electoral rolls, and basically the RNC doesn't have anything like the resources. So Republicans running require their help, and it seems that they've been very strategic in going after the states, which is what you wrote about in your piece in The Guardian. And it's starting in 2010, of course, with Karl Rove, they really did turn things around. Enormous gerrymandering, and now we're faced with the next census coming up in 2020. And to some extent, the Democrats have made some gains in the last election in that. But just some of the statistics worth letting the audience in on here. During President Obama's time in office, the Democratic Party lost over 900 state legislative seats. Over 8 years, the Republican Party won control over two-thirds of the nation's state legislative chambers. And there are obvious advantages to going at the state level, which has been largely under the radar. So just give us a quick thumbnail sketch of this Koch brothers strategy and how it could perhaps be reversed, and maybe it is beginning to be reversed.
Yeah, I actually quote in the book a man named Mark Holden, who is the director of Koch Industries Government and Public Affairs Operations, boasting at a Koch donor summit, saying that the critics of the Koch network don't have the real path. He says, we're close to success, and the critics don't have the real path. And he was right about that. I think that a lot of critics of the Koch network have not realized how incredibly strategic they were in those in the state-based strategy to take control of as many states as possible, within those states to rig the rules against democracy, with the most radical and sophisticated gerrymander in our political history, with voter suppression measures, with the efforts to destroy labor unions and so forth. And then also the other reason they're going to the states is because they are actually pushing toward the first state-convened constitutional convention in our political history. Under Article 5 of the Constitution, it has never been tried before, and they have now gotten authorizations from 28 of the 34 states needed to convene a constitutional convention to radically change our entire national rule book. And they are actually, that means, you know, six states away from that. And fortunately, there were, before the election, there were six Republican-controlled states that had not yet authorized. Now there are five. So their road just got harder with the, you know, progressives really organizing at the state level and turning things around there. But this is such a serious, well-considered, multi-level integrated strategy. It is not going to go away easily. And frankly, I think people need to be organizing nonstop all the time now, realizing that this is an all-hands-on-deck emergency for democracy in America. And it is so much deeper than Donald Trump. As one of my readers said, who is a public health nurse, he is the tumor, not the cancer.
And again, I'm speaking with Nancy McLean, who's the award-winning author of Behind the Mask of Chivalry and Freedom is Not Enough. She's the William H. Chafe Professor of History and Public Policy at Duke University, and her latest book is Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right Stealth Plan for America. And she has an article at The Guardian, Democrats Were Once Invisible in State Politics. Those days are over. So let's talk a little about how dangerous the conventions of the states is, invoking Article 5, which has never been done, because basically it was a pretty radical proposal, and it takes the Constitution itself back to being a blank sheet of paper, in effect. Once you open a convention of the states, all bets are off, aren't they? And anything is possible.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the people who are organizing for this are trying to reassure people that they will only pass a limited number of measures, that they're only going to do a few things. But every serious independent legal authority on this and nonpartisan groups like Common Cause, which have been working hard on this, have shown that there's just no way that you could control this. The Constitution only provides for how you get to such a convention. But once it's convened, you know, it's it's a free for all, really, and they could do whatever they want to do. And I think it's highly significant that not only are they pushing for the kind of billionaire and multimillionaire, you know, hard right agenda for changing our political economy and undermining the popular victories of the 20th century, but they are also in league with the religious right, and some of the key figures leading the Convention of States have deep ties to the religious right in America and to some of its most radical wings. So this is really, really serious stuff, and people need to start paying attention to it. It has been getting some more attention. You know, there have been individual pieces in, like, the New York Times, the Washington Post, I think the Atlantic, the Intercept. But it's almost like, you know, each one of those is published maybe one piece. And when you think about that compared to any one of, you know, you could say 100 outrageous Donald Trump tweets, the coverage is infinitesimal compared. So I think that we have to realize that this president is a distractor in chief. You know, what he does is awful. We need to change the culture, but we also need to not take our eyes off the prize, which is that these people are distracting us. They're trying to turn us against one another, trying to turn us against, you know, people beyond our borders. But really, it's all in the service of moving this arch-right billionaire and multimillionaire agenda. And I think it's important to say it's an arch-right billionaire and multimillionaire agenda, because there are plenty of millionaires and some billionaires who don't want this, right? Who understand that it would be devastating to our country, that it's utterly, you know, it would create an utterly unsustainable society. And I think that we have to get them, you know, out of the woodwork and paying attention and calling out, you know, kind of breaking down the corporate alliances that are enabling this Koch project to go further, because everybody is going to be devastated by this in the end. And just the most obvious case is climate change. You know, there you are in California, which is going through what just seems to be the apocalypse now, being made worse by climate change. And the Koch network is one of the top sources of climate science misinformation and denial, but also organizing actively to stop action on climate change.
Well, it just happens, and it's highly coincidental, shall we say, that the Koch brothers' political philosophy, this, as you refer to it, as Charles Koch is a libertarian zealot, and you point out that over the decades, nearly all of his policies have won through collective action on the part of citizens over the past century, from graduated income taxes. He wants to get rid of all of these, everything that's been won by the average person, such as graduated income taxes on workers' rights, Social Security, Medicare, anti-discrimination laws, and environmental regulation. So it is extremely coincidental, I'm being sarcastic, that the Koch brothers' political philosophy should fit so perfectly with their business interests. So I don't see them so much in terms of politics, but more in terms of sort of robber barons. And it is a flashback to the Gilded Age, because that is what they want to return the United States to. Because, you know, I think it was the 17th Amendment. I can't remember exactly which one it was. Mm-hmm. Prior to that being passed, state legislatures chose the U.S. senators. And that was amazingly corrupt and a total invitation for plutocrats to rig the Senate with their cronies. And direct election of senators only came in with that amendment. And so you can just see from that the kind of America that they want us to return to.
Yeah, I think that's really important that you point that out. That is one of the measures, one of the constitutional amendments they want to get at this constitutional convention, is to get rid of the direct election of senators, that progressive era victory. And as you say, it's because they understand that state governments are the most easily dominated by corporations, right? People pay more attention to local government, they pay more attention to national government, but at the state level, corporations and you know, the religious right and others can get away with a lot, because until quite recently, the progressive side of politics wasn't paying attention to state politics very much. So I think that's one of the exciting things about this recent election, is that people have started paying attention. There is great organizing going on, you know, all across the country in places that you might not expect, too. You know, in Arizona, you know, I've seen incredible stuff going on. You know, there was a Koch-backed measure to essentially privatize public education, to drain huge amounts of money, unlimited amounts of money, off to private, unregulated charter schools. And six mothers in Arizona organized a Save Our Schools movement and won with almost no money. I think they spent much less than $100,000. With almost no money, they won a thumping 2-1 victory in this, whatever that was last Tuesday. So that's an example of the kind of thing going on. But just all over the place, there is really, really smart organizing going on, even at the precinct level, you know, in so many places. So I think, you know, I've heard it said that Donald Trump is a Martian sent from outer space to unify the American left. And I think there is some truth to that, you know, that people are really waking up. You know, not enough. We need more people to get active. But the crew of people who have been in action, you know, particularly since Donald Trump was elected, have been just doing really amazing work. And I think it deserves to get a lot more attention so that other people can be inspired and take cues from it. And that's why I was trying to lift it up in that Guardian piece.
Well, but along with unifying the left, Trump is also, I think, activated the center, and American politics are in the center. And you can tell from this last election how many, particularly the so-called educated suburban women, have defected from the Republican Party. But the great success so far of the Kochs, among the fact that, as we pointed out, they've managed to change the entire thinking in this country, where a handful of billionaires earning $10,000 and more an hour have managed to convince a lot of people earning $40 an hour that America's biggest problem comes from people earning $8 an hour. So that is a major success. But it's essentially the Citizens United and how they've been right out of the gate in taking advantage of Citizens United through these dark money vehicles that they've used. 40% of the money that went into the last election was dark money, unattributed. And that has been so amazingly corrosive. But the good news is that people like Beto O'Rourke have shown, and before him, Bernie Sanders, have shown that you can run a competitive campaign just on small donations. And that, to my mind, is the biggest opening. And the trap that the Democratic Party is in, and now they're voting for Nancy Pelosi, who's great at raising funds. Well, you know, the tragedy of American politics is that all of our legislators, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, essentially telemarketers who spend their days dialing for dollars.
That
is the reality. So how do you get around that inherent corruption? The best way is to have small donations and not rely because, you know, at the end of the day, the Republicans have more of a natural affinity with the donor base, the Kochs, because of their ideology and politics, whereas the Democrats essentially have to get their money from the same big donors, but they have to lie to their voters who are being screwed by the big donors.
Yeah, I quite agree. I think, you know, it's always good to remember that old adage that there are two sources of power, ultimately, you know, money and people. And the right has turned to the stealth strategy that it has precisely because people like Charles Koch know that the vast majority would never want the agenda they're trying to bring into being by stealth, as I talk about in the book. So they have brought all this money to bear, and they are misleading the very people they're relying on to go to the polls and get their the candidates who toe their line into office. But on the progressive side, you know, as you point out, there are huge numbers, right? And people able to give small contributions. And you're quite right. Also, Bernie's campaign was huge in getting people energized for the political process. So I think in many ways, too, it was Bernie's campaign that laid the groundwork for people being able to know what to do with all the resistors who got into politics for the first time after Trump was elected, if you see what I mean. There was kind of a, you know, they kind of prepared, tilled the soil, and then helped, you know, guide people a lot, along with groups like Indivisible that arose later. But the money in politics thing is huge, and the Koch legal operations also pushed for Citizens United, of course, because they understood what they would be able to do with the spigots open and that dark money. So I think ultimately what this points to is that it's not enough to simply treat this as a partisan thing, right, and say electing Democrats is the solution in the continuing system that we have, because Democrats, too, as you suggest, will feel the pressure to do the wrong thing because the rules are broken in our system. So there are a number of groups that are coming together on an agenda to unchain democracy, they're calling it, and basically saying the first thing that these newly elected Democrats should be held accountable to at the state level, but also in Washington, is pro-democracy reform to unrig the rules of our politics. So they should be, and constituents and organizations should be pushing to say, you know, day one in office, you know, automatic voter registration, right? Public financing of elections, you know, transparency about contributions, re-enfranchisement of former felons, you know, all those kinds of things that the right has used to skew our politics so that they don't represent the majority interest and they represent these extreme right billionaires. Those things can be undone with a smart agenda of rules change for, you know, a progressive set of rules.
Right. And just in closing, another hopeful thing along with the small donations changing the donor landscape, getting rid of gerrymandering by the state commissions. A good example of the challenge ahead is that the Republicans got 12 of the, they won 12 of Ohio's 16 U.S. House seats, despite only winning 52% of the vote. And they also managed to hold on to supermajorities in Ohio's legislature, despite losing the total state legislative votes. So there's a clear and flagrant example of the success of the Koch brothers' financed gerrymandering that took place in 2010 and 2011.
Absolutely. And my state is the same. Democrats actually won 50.3% of the vote, so actually the majority, and yet only got three congressional seats to the Republicans' 10. So this gerrymander is just outrageous. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I think also calling for, and that is one of the things that is crucial, is independent redistricting, because Democrats did gerrymandering too, never as egregiously as the Republicans, you know, have done it, but they did some. And I think this is a way to reassure all citizens that we're not talking about, you know, rigging the rules so another party can win. We're talking about setting up a system that is truly democratic, right? Mm-hmm. Where people can, you know, elect their officials rather than having the officials choose their voters, as is happening in so many places now. So there's really a whole suite of pro-democracy reforms that we need to get into place as, you know, agenda item one in 2019 to get started and then, you know, continue rolling out over the next several election cycles.
Well, Nancy McLean, I thank you so much. We could talk on for a long time, but
it's always a pleasure, Ian. Thank
we've run
you.
Out of time. Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Nancy McLean, who's an award-winning author of Behind the Mask of Chivalry and Freedom is Not Enough. She's the William H. Chafe Professor of History and Public Policy at Duke University, and her latest book is Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right Stealth Plan for America. And she has an article at The Guardian, Democrats Were Once Invisible in State Politics. Those days are over. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into while the Republican Party is the party of the billionaires, the Democratic Party is the party of the millionaires, with the Democrats winning 42 of the 50 wealthiest districts in the country in the last election. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Matt Karp, who's a professor of history at Princeton University and the author of This Vast Southern Empire, Slaveholders at the Helm of American Foreign Policy. And he has an article at Jacobin Magazine, 51% Losers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Karp.
Hi. Thanks for having me in.
Well, thanks, Matt. And you were arguing in your article that the midterms have given the Democratic Party a boost, but the party's professional class politics are a cul-de-sac, and that we desperately need a political revolution driven by the needs and aspirations of the multiracial working class. So now you have all of these idealistic young freshman congresspeople coming into the Democratic Party. And the first argument out of the gate is whether or not to make Nancy Pelosi the speaker. The arguments in favor of her is that she's great at raising funds. And the arguments against her from these freshman class, who were probably similar to the influx that happened in 1974, is basically, well, we on the campaign trail said that we didn't support her. And the first vote you're asking us to make is to elect her. So back to politics as usual? Is that what's happening?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. You know, the fight to depose Pelosi is not being led right now by the left. It's sort of, even though I think, you know, a lot of left-wing, some of the left-wing candidates like, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you know, most prominently have been very critical of Nancy Pelosi. It seems like, from what I gather, although I haven't tracked this, like a reporter would have tracked this, but my understanding is that the Seth Moulton and some of the sort of more centrist, actually, and some of the sort of new suburban candidates that they just elected in these sort of swing districts are the ones who are most keen to immediately dump Pelosi. I'm not sure how well the axis over Pelosi lines up with this. I mean, in my view, Pelosi does kind of represent the sort of liberal but very class-bound sort of politics that the Democrats, from a left-wing perspective, the Democrats are really hobbled by, and you know, are unable to sort of address the larger crises that are affecting our society. But at the same time, I'm not at all confident that this movement against Pelosi will replace her with anybody, at least as it's currently, in the shape it's currently in. I'm not confident that it will replace her with anybody better on that front. Sure. We'll see. We'll see. The left, the kind of progressive caucus, hasn't really moved so far.
Well, I brought it up because Nancy Pelosi does represent a wealthy district, and you argue in your article that the mm-hmm. Democrats have become the party of the prosperous. Now, to be fair, I think the Republicans are still, if the Democrats are the party of millionaires, the Republicans are the party of billionaires. But the statistic that you show is pretty alarming, that of the wealthiest 40 districts in this country, 35 of them just elected a Democrat, and of the wealthiest 50, 42 of them just elected a Democrat. So,
yeah, I mean, you know, the nature of our system, I guess, when you have, you know, only two parties really are competitive, that both parties can be at least present themselves as and actually operate as parties of the prosperous. So it's unquestionable that the Republicans draw a lot of support from the rich. And I think, according to exit polls, they still maintain a slim advantage, although that advantage is narrower than it's almost ever been before in terms of wealthy people making over six figures voting almost 50-50 between Republican and Democrat now, which is so different from the way things used to be even 20 years ago. Yeah, I mean, I don't think so far this movement, I mean, there's a lot of debate out there, and, you know, the reaction to the article, you know, a lot of people continue to say that, hey, actually, if you look at who these middle-class voters, even these upper-middle-class voters, actually, they are feeling economic insecurity, and that's what's leading them to sort of support progressive policy, and this really isn't such a problem, because the Orange County, California, and Fairfax County, Virginia, are actually going to be all in for Medicare for All. Personally, I'm not convinced yet. I'm skeptical that this path, even as it may have been, you know, tactically necessary to get to 51% in the House of Representatives, I'm worried that the longer term coalition it's building actually deepens the divide in the working class and creates a party that doesn't have a lot of incentive to not to sort of talk about progressive policy, but to fight for it. I'm skeptical that all of these members from these rich districts, however individually, you know, kind of they may position themselves ideologically, when push comes to shove, we see a lot of, you know, we saw Bill de Blasio. Few national politicians were more showily progressive than Bill de Blasio. But then when Amazon came knocking, you know, he was first in line to, you know, spend a couple billion dollars on tax breaks for this mega billion-dollar company rather than, you know, fixing the subway. So I just don't trust that individual sort of ideological pronouncements are going to overcome a support base that leans more and more on people who don't actually need these things in the same way that working class people may.
Well, as you point out in your article, President Obama's former press secretary, Jay Carney, is now a senior vice president at Amazon, and he was the face of Amazon's big announcement of where they were putting their new facilities in suburban Washington, in Virginia,
right,
and in New York. So I was speaking earlier in the program with Nancy McLean, who wrote the book Democracy in Chains, pointing out the power of the plutocracy, and particularly of the Koch brothers. And the other day I spoke with Larry Lessig at Harvard, who made a very, I think, a very pungent and telling point. He said, it's sort of diagnosing America at the moment succinctly. He said that a handful of Americans making $10,000 an hour have managed to convince a lot of Americans making $40 an hour that the biggest problem facing America are people earning $8 an hour.
That's interesting. That's a nice formulation. I do think the class dynamics, you know, of the sort of our party politics are in some ways, you know, I mean, historically, look, I study the 19th century as my job, and I'm aware, as you know, as you know, some critics have pointed out, that, you know, this isn't new in a certain sense, that the American working class has always been sort of riven by, has always struggled with sort of ethno-cultural tensions, racial tensions, all these divisions, you know, often enhanced and exaggerated very intentionally on the part of various, you know, sort of upper class groups. And so in that sense, it's the assumption shouldn't be, the starting assumption shouldn't be, oh, of course the working class should, you know, automatically be united and to resist the sort of economic exploitation of their betters. That's the rare case, not the normal one. And yet, you know, from my perspective as somebody on the left, that's still the kind of politics that I think are necessary, as unlikely and as unsuccessful as it's been so far. And to me, so the idea that, you know, certain mega billionaires on the right, for instance, would be really interested in kind of demonizing a foreign other or a really poor kind of underclass in order to win lower middle class or even working class votes, that's a standard tactic of the right. That's divide and rule. That's of course, they're going to employ racial divisions and, you know, just white racism, appeals to white identity, to sort of underline, sort of enhance their appeal to those voters. What's more troubling to me in a certain way is that a lot of elite Democrats and liberals increasingly seem to be sort of willing to let white working class voters go and, in effect, write them off as sort of outside the boundaries of any kind of class politics, in favor of just sticking with the current coalition in which, you know, largely wealthy metropolitan, you know, college-educated Democrats run the ship, and the votes, in to a large extent, come from non-white working-class voters who really have nowhere else to go, and who are, you know, by the numbers, already not enthusiastic voters in the same way that the upper-class voters are. So I just think that whole division is not just on the Republican side, because, you know, from my perspective, the right wing is always going to employ these divisions and this kind of their main struggle is to preserve minority rule, in a sense. Whereas the party of the left, the kind of progressive, democratic, egalitarian party, our mission, and I guess I am speaking as a partisan here, our mission is to harness the many against the few. And so I do find it sort of pernicious when Democrats seem to be moving away from at least a large chunk of the many. That's how I see it.
Well, allow me to offer up a little optimism.
that, okay. Please, from, please.
from the election results, and that is the extent to which, and Bernie Sanders showed the way earlier, but the fact that Beto O'Rourke outraised Cruz, he certainly didn't win, unfortunately, but he outraised Cruz with small donors. And my sense is that the way that the powerful in this country have captured our politics is that they've made our politics about money, not about candidates and policies and ideas, but about money. And Citizens United has given that the stamp of approval of the courts to the extent that...
I thought you were going to give me good news.
No, well, I'm just laying the groundwork here that they... You know, you've got dark money, 40% at least of the money that went into this last election was dark money, and that's the victory of the Koch brothers. But I'm suggesting here that what's happened to all of our politicians, both Republican and Democrat, is that they've become telemarketers. They spend their days dialing for dollars. And that is the way that the ruling class captures them and controls them. So if you can find an end run around that, because the paradox that the Democrats have is that they get their money from the same donor class as the Republicans, but the Republicans have a natural fit with the donor class ideologically and politically. Whereas the Democrats have to lie to their constituents in order to get the money from the donor class who are screwing their voters.
Yeah, and there has to be an end run around that, and I'm not sure where it is. I mean, I know, so in a national race like the 2016 primary, and in an effectively national race, or you know, Texas is you know literally was a nation, and in my book it was a nation. It's still in virtually a nation in extent, a vast kind of race like that. It does seem like it's possible for talented candidates to overcome structural advantages and outraise their opponents, but. If you look at but I don't. I just wonder if that's possible on district races or even on races in poorer, smaller states, and let alone state legislature type races. If the small donor solution is one that can work, I know I was sort of. Did some work for Julia Falzar, who is, you know, a kind of socialist candidate who ran on the Democratic line in Brooklyn for state Senate. And her campaign, I don't know how much, they just basically didn't think that small donors, unless you could kind of nationalize the race, which didn't really happen except at the end for other reasons, it was hard to kind of count on that influx of cash. So I don't know how to make that possible if you're running, say, for Ohio legislature to sort of tap into that. And I worry that it might not be there, actually, aside from a few showpiece races. I mean, what do you think?
Well, I don't know that it's a solution, but it's a partial solution. I think the greater problems with our democracy, if we can take the liberty of calling it that, is the structural problems into the future. By 2040, the Republicans will control 70 Senate seats and the Democrats only 30, because people are moving from the red states into the blue states, where the population gets concentrated in blue state urban centers and their votes get diluted as a result because of the Electoral College and because of gerrymandering. So as long as the Republicans control the Senate into the future, they will control the courts. And we're reaching a point of a threshold now where the bad news from this election is more Republican senators will vote through more dreadful judges that Trump will be foisting on the judiciary to the point where it may have crossed the point of no return.
Yeah, there's not much good news on that front either. I mean, I think zooming out, and this wasn't the focus of my piece, but I think other commentators, you know, Jed Purdy and Dissent and elsewhere pointed out how this really deepens the problem of democracy and the problem of minority rule. And, you know, the Republican assault on voting rights, you know, in places like Georgia, but also just the sort of structural dependence on via, you know, in effect, the Constitution, the Electoral College, and the power of the Supreme Court on these sort of anti-majoritarian institutions causes a real problem. So in that sense, I mean, if your diagnosis of the moment is the most important thing to do is to claw back at this anti-majoritarian power by any means necessary, then in that sense, I do have some sympathy with, you know, flooding the suburbs, flooding anywhere where you think you can make a dent. And in that sense, I'm not so much being ultra critical of even the Democratic leadership's tactics in that regard. But I just wonder in the longer run, if you're at all interested in building any kind of, especially, you know, with organized labor losing steam and power and influence every day under the under the pressure from Republican courts. To me, the only way to actually break the cycle in the longer run, rather than simply, you know, at best, you know, trade power with minority rule Republicans, the only way to actually sort of build towards creating a full majority rule society is empowering the working class. And I worry that the sort of Democratic turn away from that won't serve that project in the long run.
Well, let me just read the last paragraph of your article, which I think makes a powerful case in that regard. The only power to curtail the rising empire of finance in the United States, W.E.D. Du Bois wrote during the Gilded Age, was industrial democracy, votes and intelligence in the hands of the laboring class, black and white, north and south. And the hands of the laboring class in the struggle against capitalist power, they are the only thing that can save us. That was true in 1868, it was true in 1938, and it remains true in 2018. So, I mean, I don't think you'll get an argument out of me or any of our listeners that the Democratic Party should return to its roots. Easier said than done, and I find it a crying shame that this complete con man, interloper, fraud, Donald Trump, has managed to capture a lot of the white working class. It's absolutely heartbreaking.
It is. And I think, I don't want to be, again, I don't want to pretend as if there aren't major obstacles, you know, in terms of the power and the ongoing power of Trump's sort of nativist and, you know, sort of racist appeal to a lot of these voters. That being said, I think as sort of I quoted a piece by the political scientist Lily Geismer and Matt Lasseter in the article, I think, you know, we can't, as we talk about the rise of Trump or the rise of a sort of a populist, you know, right that, you know, makes winning appeals to white working class voters, we can't leave out the other side of the equation, which is the way in which Democratic policy, even under, certainly under Clinton, but then even under Obama, really pivoted away from labor liberalism. Obama, you know, just the truth is he didn't prioritize. He campaigned on doing the Employee Free Choice Act. You know, labor leaders were really hopeful that he was going to prioritize that. And for whatever reason, after the financial crisis, didn't prioritize it at all. Neither did the congressional or senatorial Democrats. They had 60 votes and they couldn't do a thing for organized labor. And then, you know, when the housing bubble popped, you know, he had Goldman Sachs guy Tim Geithner running the Treasury Department, and they bailed out the banks and not the homeowners. So, you know, it's like the idea that only Trump and the Republicans are the source of this shift on the part of white working class voters just isn't plausible to me. And if we don't get our houses cleaned up at home first and really repudiate those policies, the legacy of those policies, and commit to labor liberalism, if the Democratic Party can't even commit to that, then it's just going to get worse.
Well, Matt Kopp, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate the conversation.
All right. Thank you, Ian. And I'm not much more optimistic than I was before, but we'll see.
Well, if you're looking for me to be the font of optimism, I think you come to the wrong place. But
okay.
I try.
Thanks for inviting me on the show, Ian. I appreciate it.
Trying to build a reality-based community in post-truth America.
That's hard enough to do.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Ian. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Matt Kopp, a professor of history at Princeton University and the author of This Vast Southern Empire, Slaveholders at the Helm of American Foreign Policy. And he has an article at Jacobin Magazine, 51% Losers. We're going to take a brief station break and back assessing whether dysfunction in the White House is devolved into dementia. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mike Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate Budget Committees. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And his latest book is The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lofgren.
It's good to be here.
So there you are in Washington, D.C., and we know that there's this large blimp that follows Trump around, the baby Trump blimp.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have a man-child, a baby in the White House who's now pouting. Former Secretary of State John Kerry basically said, we have a child running U.S. foreign policy. But it's as alarming as that is, it now turns out that his wife, a former Slovenian model, seems to be wielding her power as well and deciding who gets to be on the National Security Council.
Well, yes, that's true. And as a general rule, first ladies, or let's, you know, degender the matter and say first spouses, are not elected in their own right. And this is as problematic as, in the case of Nancy Reagan, determining his schedule based on what her astrologer said, or for that matter, even let's be bipartisan, Hillary Clinton did not have a mandate to remake health care in 1993, and in so doing violated things like the open meetings rule that you have to have these things in public. So as a general rule, it's a pretty bad idea. On the other hand, that's somewhat mitigated by the fact that this person who was canned by her, essentially Mira Ricardo, is pretty much a John Bolton mini-me and has the same abrasive personality, the same sense that only they stand up for national security by their own peculiar definition of it, and is just a bully and generally an unpleasant person. So the origin of this spat that supposedly Melania considered her a bully and she considered some of Melania's entourage to be childish and not behaving correctly, they're probably both right.
Well, she's been shunted off somewhere, Ricardel. I don't know where. Do you know where she's been shunted to?
That is not clear at the moment. She'll presumably land on her feet. It's an illustration also of how there's a kind of reverse Darwinism involved in selecting personnel for the Trump administration. Prior to that, she was Mira Baratta, and she was born Mira Radelovic, and is of Croatian descent. Her father was a, supposedly, according to Wikipedia, a zealous supporter of the fascist Ustasha during the Second World War. And as I recall her as Mira Baratta on the Hill in the 1990s, it's a debatable question whether and on what terms the United States should have intervened in the Balkans. But she was a zealous partisan on the side of the Croats, and that's really not something you should do when you're a foreign policy professional. And for all the fact that Milosevic and his entourage committed crimes, there was a little incident called Operation Storm, which was essentially a lot of killing and ethnic cleansing by Croatia against ethnic Serbs living in the western part of Bosnia and in Croatia. So it was hardly a straightforward matter for the United States to intervene. And this kind of rabid partisanship does not serve our country's foreign policy well.
Well, she sounds a lot like that dreadful Hungarian fascist that they had in the White House.
Yes, Sebastian Gorka.
Right.
And I suppose, getting somewhat facetious here, I suppose the fact that she crossed swords with Melania and got fired showed that, in spite of the Dayton Agreement, the Slovenes and the Croatians still do not get along.
Oh, I didn't think about that subtext. But those old wounds live on, do they not?
So, oh, yes, they do, unfortunately.
So apparently Trump is really losing it because he feels that Mueller is squeezing him and moving in on him, and the Democrats now have subpoena power. It's possible that tomorrow, Friday, there'll be some indictments come down. I don't know whether Whitaker has been able to stop Mueller in his tracks. Nobody seems to know what's going on at the DOJ. Maybe you have some insight. But so the latest tweets from Trump are pretty hysterical about Mueller, as though Trump is a cornered animal in the White House. I'm pretty sure that this guy is incredibly guilty. He's both a criminal and possibly a traitor. So where do you see things? Because at the end of the day, this may be the way the Trump presidency implodes. Some people think he'll be marched out of the Oval Office in an orange jumpsuit. Others think in a straitjacket. But I think he's going to end up like a character in the movie Network, Howard Beale, ranting on national television. But that maybe is a fantasy on my part.
Well, the law is one thing, and I would tend to agree with you. It's open and shut virtually on obstruction statutes and presumably also his foreknowledge of the June 2006 meeting with Donald Jr. and company in Trump Tower with the Russians. So,
but I don't think
on that score. But yeah. Then politically, how that plays out, I'm certainly not Nostradamus. Now, his new appointee to run DOJ, it now turns out he could have fallen afoul of the appointments statutes of how you appoint specifically an attorney general. If you read the statutes carefully, the acting head of DOJ now is the current deputy attorney general, Rod Rosenstein, the precise person who is the stone in Trump's shoe. So there will presumably be lawsuits over this, and the fact that at least the Democrats have one chamber under their control means it's touch and go as to whether Whitaker can actually do anything with respect to the Mueller investigation, certainly whether he can do it legally.
Right. Well, I don't think Mueller's going to go. I think he's decided not to indict the president, but I don't think that's.
He will probably remain an unindicted co-conspirator.
Yeah. Right. And
the thrust of what what Mueller is getting at will be evident from all the indictments, which, when you look at them cumulatively, amount to the so-called report that we're all expecting. The indictments are very clear and detailed on the sequence of events.
Well, you can almost read the roadmap just looking at who's indicted, and particularly on the court filings, which are very, very unusually detailed. I think that's how he's getting his message out about what he's up to. And if you've got the president's campaign manager, who was clearly tied to Putin and the Ukrainian and Putin's Ukrainian puppet and Russian intelligence through his number two guy, the GRU Colonel Konstantin Kalimnik, you've got Michael Cohen, who allegedly went to the Czech Republic to meet with Russians to pay them off for the hacking that went on at the internet troll factory in St. Petersburg. You've got Michael Flynn, who apparently was compromised very, very early by the Russians. He met with a honey trap in at a conference at Cambridge University. God knows what he's been able to tell. I have a feeling this thing's going to be blown wide open at some point or other, if not soon.
Well, who can tell? I'm not going to speculate. I would simply say the evidence would seem to be overwhelming how that plays out ultimately. It's unfortunate, but when you reach that level, justice is a political matter, and justice is not blind.
Well, my focus is largely on national security and foreign policy, and what I find extraordinary, Mike Lofgren, is that Vladimir Putin is in Singapore as we speak at a special ASEAN-Russian summit. And for a guy that's murdered people in Salisbury, England, with nerve gas and killed dissident KGB officer who was about to expose his ties to a big mob boss laundering money in Spain, Litvinenko, poisoned with polonium, and shooting down a passenger airliner, Malaysian passenger airliner, all of the stuff that he's done, he's nevertheless very effective diplomatically. And the only conclusion I can come to is that the reason that Putin and Xi Jinping are doing well on the world stage is that our president is entirely absent on the world stage. And when he shows up on the world stage, he manages to irritate everybody with his churlish, childish behavior.
Well, that's the case. Sometimes it's just a matter of showing up and behaving well. You don't have to be the greatest statesman since Metternich. The United States, we tended to underestimate, and now we realize fully just how much prestige and soft power and cultural power the United States possessed. It was harkens back to the Cuban Missile Crisis when American diplomats were saying to General de Gaulle, "Oh, well, can we have Adlai Stevenson show you the photographs of the missile sites?" And de Gaulle said, "No, I don't need to see them. The word of President Kennedy is good enough." Now, who's going to take Donald Trump's word?
Well, but he's not even showing up. He's not showing up in Singapore at the ASEAN summit. He didn't show up when King Abdullah of Jordan shows up. He didn't even show up at Arlington on Veterans Day.
Right, as he didn't show up at the American Cemetery in France.
Right.
The day before the official commemoration when he was supposed to. So, yes, he's been pretty much AWOL. When you spend half your time tweeting and watching Fox and Friends, and the other half going to campaign rallies paid for by the taxpayer, that doesn't leave much time for diplomacy and governance.
Well, just in closing, Mike, back to my fantasy that Trump's going to end up like Howard Beale screaming from the rooftops like a madman. Except, of course, Howard Beale in Network was a very intelligent guy, and what he had to say was really interesting. The gibberish coming from Trump lately about people walking around the block putting hats on and disguising so they can vote for a second time is pure insanity. So what's your prognosis in the last minute?
I tend, again, not to be Nostradamus. I think we'll see more of the same that we've seen in the last 2 years, because past tends to be prologue, intensified somewhat by the fact that the Democrats now control the House. I think they're wise to concentrate on the payoffs rather than the Mueller business. Leave that to Robert Mueller. Plus, although the Russian business is much more serious and important for the United States national security, the average person has trouble following it. It is rather intricate, but everybody understands sex and payoffs.
Well, Mark Lofgren, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It was good to be here.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Mike Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate Budget Committees. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And his latest book is The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.